I do bring you greetings, not just from the News Bureau, but from the entire editorial department in Pasadena. Well, here it is in December 1979. The world is careening around the corner, not only ending a year, but ending a decade as we move into 1980 and the 80s. And we see the world is confronted with a number of serious, serious problems. The headline in today's paper was, Four OPEC Countries Raise Prices 20%. Kind of like what else is new. You know, this came after 33% increases, if not more, on the part of other members of the oil cartel. We say various pronouncements that in the 80s we could see time of critical energy shortages. Some are even coining words such as petrol crash. You know, looking back to the 1929 economic stock market crash, they're coining this new word petrol crash. We see that gold is up over $500. The dollar is shaky. It seems that all currencies really are shaky when compared with the solid metal. We look at the Middle East, and Mr. Armstrong has told us for years, if not decades, focus your mind on the Middle East. Maybe we couldn't quite see 10, 20, 30 years ago why we should do so. But then the establishment of the Nation of Israel in 1947-48, that, as the Arab states, many of the radical Arab states see as the opening wedge of westernization, Western interest in the Middle East. So that became a sore point that has led to numerous wars. And then also the dependence now of the entire Western world and even the United States during the 1970s, looking back at this last decade, dependence of the United States upon this very unstable part of the world. And of course, one of the most unstable factors right now is Iran. Few have realized before the fall of the Shah how important that man was to the Middle East, especially with the pullback of Britain. Britain had various sea bases, part of her birthright, shall we say, blessing or commitment. And she pulled out of Aden. She pulled out of various other sea bases she had around the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. She pulled back all the way from her former thin red line, you know, that went from Britain through the Mediterranean down to the Red Sea, around Arabia, Indian Ocean, and out to Singapore. She pulled all the way back to become a shrunken little England. She gave up her responsibilities. And of course, there are always, whenever that happens, there are power vacuums. Others are ready and willing to move in. And the Soviet Union certainly is that type of a power. And right now, or rather, after Britain pulled back, then someone had to take over the role of responsibility of the Persian Gulf, the policeman of the Gulf. And the Shah of Iran willingly undertook that responsibility, perhaps against the will of his own people in many respects, at least certain aspects of his own society. And he became the policeman of the Gulf, but he couldn't hold it. Britain could, as a neutral power, but not Iran, which had difficulties with other Arab states, Iran being Islamic, but not Arab. Iran collapsed. Iran is today a mess, absolute mess. The only thing that held that country together was the peacock throne of Shah Pahlavi dynasty. I don't think many people realize how divided that country really was underneath. That the Persian people themselves comprise only about half of the population. You have the Baluchis, you have the Arabs, the Azerbaijanis, and numerous other minorities within that own country now that will not knuckle under to the rule of a Persian Ayatollah. And it was only the Shah that sat on top of this, shall we say, festering situation. He was able to keep control. And with him gone, we have a very, very unstable situation. And the Soviets are taking advantage of it. We can see what they did just in the last few days. Imagine that, shall we say, sticking it to the United States. That's all you can really say. Moving in massive amounts of troops, of personnel, flying in troop carriers around the clock for 72 hours, landing them plane after plane after plane at Kabul airport, and to where they now control that country, which is right on the border of Afghanistan. They would not have dared do that if the Shah had been in control and had had the support of the United States and the Western powers. The Soviet Union perceives weaknesses. It is the imperialistic power in the world today, and it cannot be, if any of you take my class someday in Ambassador College on international relations, you know some of the principles of dealing with imperialistic powers. You can never compromise with them. They must at best be contained, at the very least, rather, contained. The Soviet Union is aggressive. It will take advantage of opportunities. And it has a plan involving the getting control of as much of the Middle East as possible. Why? Because their own oil, by many experts now, is predicted to begin to play out in the mid-1980s. She needs oil will need oil in the Middle East pretty soon herself. The Soviet Union is a net exporter of oil. She sells oil to her East European bloc countries. She also sells oil to Finland, Sweden, Italy, and some of the other Western European powers for hard cash. She needs the money to buy technology from the West. But she is going to begin to become a net importer of oil as her own fields in the Baku and the Caspian Sea region, as they play out in the 1980s. So we will see a more dynamic move of the Soviet Union into the Middle East. The Soviets already have a clamp on the former British Seagate of South Yemen, or Yemen, or the former Aden Protectorate. They are there in force. It is the most communist, radical communist state in the area. In fact, the Soviets, a couple of weeks ago, tried an airlift exercise and maneuver, apparently as designed to see if they could carry it off there, if it would be successful in an exercise form, then they could apply some of the tactics in real form to Afghanistan, and it turned out to be successful. So we'll have to watch what happens in the Middle East. The country is living under this sword of Damocles. You know, it could be cut at any time. Look what happened in Saudi Arabia with the shootout at the mosque. Who knows how many people, you know, died there? Maybe 200-some people. Then it was a real affair for several days, which shows you how unstable, inherently unstable, so many of these vital areas are. And because of the downplay of Iran, the radical regime, Muslim regime of Iraq, is beginning to flex its muscles. It's always had bones to pick with Iran and some of the other states, especially Kuwait. Sometimes take a look at the map of the Middle East. You see there's a neutral zone between Iraq and Kuwait. Kuwait, a major oil producer. Iraq could begin to flex its muscles there. So Iraq is beginning to act up. So the Middle East, and then in Europe, in the next year, in a couple of years, we can see what is happening. Not too much politically, shall we say, yet. It all depends upon perceived weakness of the United States on the part of the Western powers. But in the meantime, as has been reported in the Plain Truth magazine, we have a very activist head of the Roman Catholic Church. Isn't it interesting that this man is traveling just as God's apostle has been traveling? Have you noticed the parallel? And this pope wants to go to China. We don't know when he'll be able to go there, but he will be going to Brazil, Haiti, and the Philippines in short form. He is making as many inroads as possible into the strong parts of his church, which lie in the third world. Western Europe, so far, recent dates, has been rather moribund, just like the Catholic Church in the United States. But we have an activist pope in the head of the church there. I'll give a real sleeper issue. My wife and I were talking about this today. She was reading Vogue magazine, of all things. You never know where you're going to find good news, interesting news of consequence. And had an article in there about the resurgence of Vienna. And what was that quote? I have it here. The old buildings sandblasted from soot to splendor. You ought to go to Vienna sometime. If you ever have a chance, some of you go to Europe en route to the Middle East, you know, at the feast time. If you have a chance, stop in Vienna. Very interesting city. Head of the Holy Roman Empire for 600 years. I've been there three times now. And every time I go there, I think something is going to happen with this city. Now, these buildings are still here for a purpose. This city has a past. It is a crossroads between East and West. And then when you go across the Danube River and see this massive, I mean massive, building complex into which only three or four UN agencies have moved. The government of Austria, 65%, the city of Vienna, 35%, have put up the cost of these structures at, frankly, great taxpayer sacrifice of the people of Austria. And I feel these buildings are going to be used for something. I don't think they're just going to remain dormant. Now, the hope of the Austrian government is that someday the United Nations, the entirety of the United Nations, will move to Vienna. That's what they hope. The United Nations, of course, is housed, headquartered in New York. But as the world turns even more sour against America, and kind of an illogical frame of mind so many nations are in against the United States, perhaps we'll see that, the removal of the United Nations to Vienna, and Vienna becoming, once again, the crossroads of East and West. We have, coincidental with that, a pope that says that there must be a spiritual basis to reunite all of Europe, both East and West, a pope who has now made remarkable overtures to the leading patriarch of the Orthodox Church, very upsetting to the rulers in the Kremlin. And so we could see perhaps someday the Roman Catholic Church sitting over a reunited church, East and West, with the capital, the spirit of the physical capital, or the secular capital, once again, Vienna. Anyway, that's, as I say, a sleeper issue. You might watch that in the next few months, maybe years. That might take a little while. We have some very important elections coming up in 1980. First of all, only 2 months away, election in Canada. You saw the other day in the newspapers that the government was toppled in a vote of confidence issue. Prime Minister Joe Clark was out after only a few months in office. The Liberals didn't even have a candidate. Ex-Prime Minister Trudeau had already announced his resignation from leadership of the party, but he's going to go back and fight the battle, and he relishes this one, because if he wins the February battle, there will be the showdown between Mr. Trudeau and his arch-rival, who is not Mr. Clark, but is René Lévesque of Quebec. And Lévesque has announced now the terms are set, were set just a few days ago for the key referendum in the province of Quebec, where in the month of May, the people of Quebec will go to vote on a single issue, very cleverly worded, but a single issue which says, do you give the government of Quebec the power to negotiate sovereign association, which is a shrewd way of saying independence, from the rest of Canada? Do you give us the power to do so? And so between February and May, you're going to see a lot about Canada in the news leading up to that crucial referendum. Quebec, of course, is very important to the United States. Most people don't realize all of Canada is. You know, we're so used to think of a common market between Germany and France and Italy and the Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, and all the other, you know, the big nine over in Europe. That is the common market. But what about an earlier common market that's gone back many decades between the United States and Canada? Tremendous billions of dollars a year of trade that flows back and forth between our two countries across a border, 4,000 miles of peace. Remarkable situation that we have taken for granted. If Canada would be divided, it would be very disastrous, not only to the Canadian economy, but to the American economy as well. Maybe some of you even drive cars, believe it or not, that are made in Canada, you know, certain type models because of the auto agreement between some of our industry here in Canada, certain models made up there. And many other influences of Canada maybe that you don't even realize. And as far as the province of Quebec is concerned, your newspapers might not even be printed if there's problems in Quebec. And you realize that? The tremendous newspaper and pulp industry in that province is rich in natural resources and minerals. The lights of New York City might go out if there's problems in Quebec, because the New York State has become dependent upon the sales of hydroelectric power from that province. We have a member in the church who is a member of the Quebec's state legislature. Well, actually, they call it the National Assembly, which they hope will be eventually a National Assembly. He's not part of the separatist movement, however, but he was very influential in designing some of the arrangements for the St. James Bay hydroelectric power project along Hudson Bay. And it's just gone on stream now, I believe. And so most of that power is being exported to New York State. Very important. So watch Canada pretty soon, in the first half of this year. Then we have two other elections in the latter part of the year. First of all, in West Germany, which will pit the incumbent chancellor, Helmut Schmidt. We think, as far as we know, he'll still be running. He has warned that if he doesn't get his way in certain party caucuses, he himself might drop out of the running, but I don't think he will. Pit Mr. Schmidt against Franz Josef Strauss. We've had articles in the Plain Truth magazine at least alerting people to the significance, possible future significance of this election. Now, until a few days ago, well, say a month or two ago, Mr. Strauss's fortunes were very, very meager. I mean, he was running behind in the polls, and some of the speeches that he'd been giving around the country were receiving very, very bad press. And in one particular incident, I forgot which place or land or state this was, but he got up on the stage and he was pelted with tomatoes, rotten tomatoes. And there were so many of the youthful radical leftist students down below heckling him so vehemently, he couldn't get in a word edgewise, and he had to walk off the stage. That's how some of the feelings against this man among the younger group of people, the radical left, how strong some of these feelings are. And so things looked bad until about a month ago when there's been a certain turn in his fortunes. And it deals with the environmental movement, believe it or not, in West Germany. And you have to understand the peculiarities of the West German electoral system. In the federal elections, as in all of the state elections, a party can obtain seats if it's running in the election if it jumps over 5% voting hurdle. In other words, if it fields a list of candidates and gets 5% of the votes, then it gets a certain share of the seats in the legislature or the federal parliament. That's simplifying matters. If it gets 4.95 or so, it doesn't get anything. Now, what looks like is happening is that the so-called green power movement, or the green parties, are becoming quite strong in Germany. Now, the environmental movement is not as powerful in France as it is in Germany. Germany is strong because the United States is very much a model for West Germany. They tend to follow things that are developing here. So if we have nuclear, young people demonstrating against nuclear power reactors here, you'll always find them a few weeks later in Western Germany. And so the environmental movement is very strong. And if the green parties can field, get 5% of the votes and land some representatives in the Bundestag, then the feeling is that their strength will come at the expense of the incumbent Chancellor Schmidt, because he represents the party that's moderate to left, the Social Democratic Party. There's very little, shall we say, empathy with environmental movement among the voters of the Christian Democratic Party, whose candidate is Strauss. So the strength would be taken away from the incumbent chancellor, and we could see by that, at least various reports that I've been reading lately, that that Mr. Strauss could get in just because of that very peculiar development that is occurring. Then, of course, about the same time, November, first Tuesday in November in 1980, the elections in the United States. Now, the election issue is pretty much moribund at this time. Mr. Carter has very shrewdly used the events in Iran to his advantage. Not that, of course, he would have wanted them or caused them, but at least they're working to his advantage, because he has proclaimed this concept that we must have national unity. The policy that I decree that we follow with regard to the hostages and so forth, this is the policy that must not be disagreed with. And, that you're playing dirty pool, Mr. Kennedy or Mr. Reagan or Mr. Brown and others, if you criticize this unity, movement toward the Iranian situation. And so he's been able to manipulate that, and he's taken much of the starch out of the campaign of the various other contestants. And so we'll have to wait and see, really, until there is a resolution of the Iranian crisis, to see which way the election is going to go in this country. Who knows? The captives on the Pueblo were there in North Korea for about a year. But Henry Farley, who was a very interesting, I think very perceptive columnist in the United States, wrote an article in the New Republic magazine showing up the importance of the coming election in our country. I think we've all felt that this is a certain benchmark. The election in 1980, we thought, well, maybe Mr. Kennedy is going to get it. Would that mean something? Well, anyway, he answered it this way. He said, in the course of the next year, the American people will decide if they want a future as a great power. The question before them is whether it matters if America matters. And the starkness of this question rightly suggests that there may be something once and for all about it. In other words, this election is not just between various personalities, it's not between parties, it's the direction the American people seem to want to go. In 1976, they wanted a man, frankly, who came from no place. Let's kind of clean out all the dirty, rotten politics in Washington. Let's draft someone who hasn't been tainted by Washington events. He's a kind of a pure soul from the South. Excuse me, this is Southeast, not Southwest. Okay, and he can breathe a breath of fresh air. But there was no real policy that Mr. Carter stood upon. And so the American people, unfortunately, at that time, appear to have purchased a pig in a poke. And because they really didn't know what his policy was, and I think they still don't know what his policy is. But anyway, this will be a fateful election, because the very future of the United States is at stake. And the issue really is one of national power. Which way is the country going to go? Will it take a little bit of a step upward, as many people wish it would? you read the public opinion polls, look on television, you know, I wish we'd do something about Iran. I wish we'd do this and that. There seems to be a certain desire on the part of the average person, but it's not translated into the rulers. It's not translated into the intellectual class, because there is a failure of will. America's course seems to be already set, regardless of the election that takes place, because the catalyst for nearly all of today's world ills, as I've been stressing in many other areas, nearly all of the world's ills, not all of them, but many of them, is the fall from power of the United States. The United States is weak today. It is perceived as being weak on the part of its allies and certainly on the part of its adversaries. Let's examine in the rest of this message then today some of the most important factors that have led to the rise of the United States to being a great power. You know, at the end of 1945, the end of World War II, it was at the very pinnacle of world power status. What were the factors that led to that preeminent position, that rise to power? And how are these elements of national power being stripped away one by one? Because if you understand these factors of power, you can understand then how the United States has lost these advantages over the last two or three decades. Theodore Roosevelt once said, now Theodore Roosevelt being one of the most honored presidents and leaders this country has ever had, he said the United States does not have a choice to play. Excuse me, does not have a choice as to whether it will or will not play a great part in the world. In other words, he said it was more or less preordained because of what we were, where we were, and what we had. Continuing, fate has made that choice for us. The only question is whether we will play that part well or badly. So he said fate has made the choice that the United States would be a world power, and it's a question of just whether the United States would play it well or whether it would play it badly. Now, of course, our leadership has come from, shall we say, a basic philosophical mold, that of humanism and deism, which downplays the supernatural. If you look back at some of the original writings of our forefathers, there was certainly respect for religion, but belief in, shall we say, the inherent qualities of human beings, you know, to settle their own fate, their own mold, that national destiny was dependent upon just their own actions. So that's why he could say fate, why he did not say God. But God is the one who determined that the United States at this particular juncture in history, or shall we say around the middle part of the 20th century, would have all of the elements of national power, would sit at the top. Let's turn over to Genesis 49. I'll show you what I mean by this before I get into some other factors from what some of the political scientists say. Now, this should be nothing new to those of you who have read Mr. Armstrong's booklet on the U.S. and Britain in prophecy, and I thought it was very interesting that once Mr. Armstrong took a firm hand again in operating and controlling the destiny of the Plain Truth magazine, one of the first things he did was to rerun the United States and Britain in prophecy, one of the fundamental truths that has built up, that understanding has built up the Church of God today. And Genesis 49:22, something that he mentioned in his series, verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over the wall. And as he has explained, and others have explained, Mr. Waterhouse, and I know some others, you know how the peoples of Joseph, especially Ephraim, have just been overflowing and filled out to all parts of the earth, to where there was nothing in the history to compare with the extent and the vastness of the British Empire. Verse 25, by the God of your father who will help you, by God Almighty who will bless you. Now these, we're talking about the Abrahamic promises that would be conferred upon our people after a certain delay. With blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that couches beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. What do these symbolic references mean? The blessings of the heaven above refers to the fact that we have settled in a very beautiful temperate zone of the earth. Notice where the nations of Israel went. Did they go to the jungles of South America or Africa? Were they consigned to the wastelands, the deserts of the earth? Of course, there's a desert in the middle of Australia, but that the coastline of Australia is still extremely wealthy. And underneath that desert is found vast mineral wealth. So So we have been given the choicest parts of the earth with rain in due season, which has enabled the people of Joseph, the descendants of Joseph, ours, our people here, and the people of the British Commonwealth, to have abundant agricultural wealth. Blessings of the deep that couches beneath, referring obviously to mineral wealth. And you really see this when you go down to South Africa and Australia. Some of our own deposits of minerals have played out in this country, but in those two areas, it is fantastic, the wealth. In both countries, special railroads have been built from the interior to the coastlands, where trains run day and night, unit trains just carrying out coal and other minerals for export to the industrial appetites of the Japanese and other mineral-poor nations of the world. Blessings of the breasts and of the womb. In other words, a sizable, healthy, sizable, and healthy. Maybe I should put it that way. Sizable and healthy population. Look at the longevity of life that our peoples have enjoyed. Fantastic. And the 70, the 70 and 10, and then beyond that, we've enjoyed longevity of life, especially when you compare with some of the peasants of India, you know, where to live to age 35 or 40, and then you look old and haggard, like you're 80. We've enjoyed these blessings. And also size of populations, very significant size. So this is what God promised He would do. He would give us, from His perspective, certain aspects of national power, greatness that would assure, if obedience were maintained to His laws, would assure a preeminent position in the world. Now, when you look at what the political scientists say, those are recognized experts in the field of international relations, they come up with, without understanding Genesis 49, they come up with some of the same factors of international power. Now, in the book that I have used for years, and it's in its, I guess, sixth revision, Politics Among Nations by Hans Morgenthau, still a classic text in this field, in chapter 9 of that book, which we had just come to, I guess this is why it's on my mind lately, the factors of national power as he sees them, and they're remarkably similar. He said there are certain factors of power which, unless a nation has most of these, cannot play a preeminent part in the world. And he says certain factors are stable and others are relatively unstable or can change as the mood of a nation changes, as the character of a people change, as the quality of its leadership and its morale change. And so he has them in descending order from stable to unstable factors. I want to give you these because we'll cover them in some detail as we go through the rest of the message. But I want to give them to you now so that at least you can jot them down, all you note takers. The first one, he says, is geography. The second one, natural resources. And he has under there two factors there, food and raw materials. Natural resources are broken down to food and raw materials. Then industrial capacity. Next, military preparedness. After that, population. And now we get into some of the, shall we say, the variable factors, the less stable ones. National character and morale. And then I want to insert one here because political scientists don't generally delve into the areas of religion or morality, and preachers don't generally go the opposite direction. And so he didn't cover this one, but I want to throw it in. National morality. Not just national morale, but national morality. And then ending up with the two, shall we say, pivotal factors. Quality of diplomacy and quality of government. I'll read them again in case you missed them. Geography, natural resources, broken down into food and raw materials, then industrial capacity, military preparedness, population, national character and morale, national morality, quality of diplomacy, and quality of government. So let's look at some of these factors and apply them to our nation today to see where our country stands, or where it did stand a decade or two ago, where it stands today and is likely to stand in the near future. As this political scientist says, I mentioned earlier, there are two groups of elements, those relatively stable and those subject to constant change. And the first one, he mentions geography. And he does draw specific attention to the United States. I think, again, we've taken for granted the fantastic blessing we've had being apart from those squabbling quarrels, fratricidal wars of Europe, that God placed us over 3,000 miles away from the warfaring continent of Europe. 3,000 miles and 6,000 miles of ocean buffer on the other side. What a fantastic factor of national power that has been for our people. Now, this factor is not as critical today as it was at the end of 1945, certainly. We have ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, which can be fired from an adversary over the pole, which can strike the United States 30 minutes after they are launched. But still, even then, the factor of geography must be taken into consideration in the calculations of such warfare. So it is a declining factor of power, but still an important one nevertheless. It has led to the protection of the United States, to where our peoples have not had to fight wars on their own soil. Now, where were World Wars I and II fought? Not in the United States, were fought overseas. Similarly, the separation of Great Britain from the European continent is not just a matter of chance. You know, God is the one who sets the times and the dates and the times of power of nations. He's the God of geography. He's the one who made this earth. So Britain has been separated from the European continent by a moat of water, which can at times be one of the most treacherous bodies of water anywhere on earth. You remember, any of you old-timers, remember in the days leading up to the invasion of the European continent, D-Day, 1944, and the planning of that attack, which goes back originally to the concepts of a brilliant man, Lord Mountbatten, whose series has been running on television, the man who was tragically assassinated by the IRA gunman a couple of months ago. That planning goes back to him, and then it was taken over by General Eisenhower. But how God had to provide just a break in the weather so that the attack forces could move from Britain over to the Normandy coast, because the English Channel can be so unpredictable. And the English Channel has protected Great Britain, and it is still a factor of British national power today. It was a factor that Adolf Hitler had to take into consideration. He tried to soften the British up in the battle for Britain, the air war. But when he couldn't do so, and the indomitable British spirit refused to knuckle under, then he turned his vengeful wrath against the Soviet Union in 1941. And once he did that, Britain's security was assured. And Britain could then become the launching pad, kind of like the floating aircraft carrier and the air bases, for the staging ground for the attack on the continent of Europe. So it was a factor of power that even Hitler, Napoleon, and others who have had designs, like Hitler did, Operation Sea Lion and so forth, designs to take over and enslave the British people. That factor they had to take into consideration. Our adversaries today, when I speak of our, meaning national adversaries, not the state of California, I have something to say about that later. But the national adversaries, the Soviet Union, the Soviets have had to take this factor of America's geographical protection into consideration. There was a very interesting interview in Der Spiegel, which is a West German news magazine. It was an interview with Georgi Arbatov, who is the head of the American Institute in Moscow. In other words, he's the Soviet Union's chief America watcher. I heard him speak one time in Los Angeles. And he was asked the question why the Soviet Union had to, build such a tremendous military force, as they've been constructing tremendous weaponry in East Europe, the SS-20 missiles and so forth. And he gave both a reason and a justification for this. And he put it in terms of the United States, comparing the United States with the Soviet Union. He said, well, let's just look at it. I have to paraphrase here because his English, translated especially from the German, is very poor. Anyway, he said, let's look at the United States, for example. He said, what if instead of Canada, the United States had above itself, in its along its northern border, a hostile military alliance, as the Soviets perceived, say, the NATO bloc, see? He said, and then instead of Mexico to the south, what if the United States had a nation of about 900 million people who had residual claims on the territory of the United States? Of course, he was referring to China, which has, disputed land claims in Siberia with that land that's held by the Soviet Union today. He said, what if, there was a military alliance to the north, and then a hostile enemy to the south? And then he said, besides that, America would, and then on top of that, what if the United States didn't have, both on the east and west flank, two oceans? And then the Spiegel editor said, but rather the Germans and the Japanese. He said, yes, precisely. In other words, enemy to the north, another adversary to the south, and then two other enemies east and west. Then the United States would have probably have to acquire a much more powerful conventional defense force. So that's the position of the Soviet Union. When you look at their geography, they have a hostile military alliance, and then two other hostile enemies, and then, of course, the Germans have been problems on the west and the Japanese on the east. So we have been indeed blessed. And the factor of geography has been a very critical one for us. It's a critical one for the Soviet Union. When you look at them, they have tremendous territory that's been both a source of great strength and great weakness for them. We've had a source of great strength, but theirs has been both. They have no defensible western border at all. That's why they have constructed an Iron Curtain. And that's another reason, too, their factor of geography is why the Soviets are moving south into the Indian Ocean. Why they, boldly moved into Afghanistan. They want to have a warm water port on the Indian Ocean, as well as secure these potential pincer points in the Middle East, where the Soviet Navy, which is building up around the world, the Blue Water Navy, can't interdict Western oil supplies. But they want warm water ports. They really don't have them today. Practically all of their ports are frozen over part of the year. Now, they have a couple of warm water ports in Khabarovsk and what's the other one over in Soviet Far East. But that's 6 days away by rail on the, from Moscow on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. So it's not a very secure one. Now, the other factor, the next factor, factor number two, natural resources. This is another relatively stable factor, not as important as that of geography, but important nevertheless. And I told you that I was going to divide this into two factors, food and raw materials. The most important of these two is food. And God has blessed us, like he said that he would do so. Blessings of the heaven above. And we've had the most fantastic agricultural wealth that any country ever has had. So much so that right now, maybe we're pushing the land. I don't deny that. Maybe our agricultural, I'm not disputing that our agricultural activities or practices are all in conformance with God's law. That's beside the point at this particular juncture. But the fact that we export about 2/3 of our grains now is a great element of national power. Earns great monetary rewards, brings in the balance of payments. Notice that the third quarter of this last year, despite the heavy payments, outlays for oil, the balance of payments in the United States was in the red because of sales of food, sales of airframe, air technology, airplanes and so forth, and also oil technology, very important. So this has been a great source of strength to the United States, that of food. Now, as far as Britain is concerned, it's a source of weakness now. Britain must import about half of her food. If any of you have been over to Britain, walked into a food store, onto the dairy counter, you find butter from New Zealand, butter from Ireland, across the Irish Sea, butter from Holland. And the same thing with the meats, come from all around the world. Refrigerated lamb, brought in 8,000 miles away from New Zealand over the lifeline, ocean lifelines of the world. Now, this was not a source of weakness for the British as long as the British had a powerful navy to police the oceans. But where is Britain's navy today? It's practically gone. Who is the up-and-coming sea power of the world? It is the Soviet Union. I just received the other day the official book by the Lord Admiralty of the Soviet Navy, Gorshkov, on the Soviet sea power, and just briefly looked through it. Obviously, it is a very aggressive policy. The Soviet Union doesn't need a massive world navy because they are self-sufficient in food and in oil so far and many of their natural resources, minerals. But they are out to interdict at times of war the lifelines of the Western powers and especially across the Atlantic, the North Atlantic. So Britain, as long as she had a big navy, to keep those lifelines open to Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and so forth, the other parts of the Commonwealth, could exist with this very dangerous statistic. At one time, it was down to only about 30% of the food that she grew. Now it's up to 45 to 50%. As far as the United States is concerned, we've had great self-sufficiency. We go to our stores today, we see a lot of products, food products from around the world. You can buy French wines, French cheese. This is a matter of choice. You know, you can still buy California wines. They're pretty good. I don't care for New York State wines, except the champagnes are pretty good. So I stick with my home state. As far as cheeses are concerned, I guess we can suffer along with Wisconsin, but the French cheeses are about the best. About 300 different types of cheeses produced in France. I don't know how many come over here. I was talking about this with the brethren in Abilene this morning. I said, you know, wouldn't you rather, if you have a choice, you know, you'd rather buy some good French cheese rather than American processed cheese. And I was joking with them about that. And the funny thing was, as we were driving here, one of the ladies had fixed a lunch for us, and then the sandwich was processed American cheese. So I'm afraid to one little offense there. But they wrote the book Famine, 1975, Who Will Survive? Well, it was past 1975, and we've had some pretty good bounteous harvests in the world, thanks to the United States. You want to know how bounteous they are? Listen to this. I'm not surprised by too many things, but this really took the wind out of my sails when I saw a quote from Lester Brown, head of the World Watch Institute. In the U.S. News and World Report recent issue, he said this: well over 100 countries are now dependent upon U.S. grain exports. Can you imagine that? Well over, there are only 150 or so countries in the world. And then when you think, who are the food exporters today? Well, all of them except one are Israelitish countries. The United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Rhodesia as a, shall we say, a small sixth one, and then Argentina. About that, beyond that, you really can't count anybody else. Now, what has happened in time and time again when countries have, as I say, have used the term, thrown off the yoke of Ephraim, especially in Africa, they've gone independent. One of the first things that happens is that the agricultural sector goes downhill. As long as the British farmers, like there are 5,000 farmers in Rhodesia, there are approximately the same number of farmers in Zambia, independent Zambia today, as long as they stay there, they're able to feed the native populations and still earn enough money and grow enough food to send food to the other nations of Africa. If it weren't for South Africa and Rhodesia, many Africans would starve today. But with the independence movement and the emphasis of the new politicians upon showboat industrial schemes, you know, and no concern really about agriculture, the people go back to subsistence farming instead of cash crop farming, the agricultural sector has gone downhill. And it's so bad now in this era of post-colonialism that the world is dangerously dependent upon a handful of sources for grains. There was a report that came out just a few weeks ago about the 1980s, again talking about the 1980s, as being a time of severe food shortages unless this production in the food exporting nations can be kept up. And yet many experts say that we're straining our soil in this country here, and that we're due for some, shall we say, a pullback on the rubber band here. There could be a severe reaction. What would happen? As you know, like Mr. Armstrong has warned, there is going to be drought in this country. We're not the only people that are going to suffer. It will be nations around the world. Getting back to this, self-sufficiency in food, source of great strength. As Mr. Paddock told me, he said, it is also a source of industrial strength. Have you ever thought of that? The great agricultural powers are also primarily the great industrial powers. You know, there are many resources available in India. But all other countries where the farmers are basically subsistence farmers, they don't earn money to put in the bank to invest, and the banks invest in industry and so forth. These countries, to develop industry, always have to seek capital from the outside. They don't generate it enough from within their own society. So by the blessings of the heaven above, we're able to have the blessings of a much, much higher standard of living industrially and technologically. Mr. Paddock also told me this interesting statistic, or as he conceived it. He said, he was talking about, he comes from Iowa and has done work at Iowa State. Of course, you know how rich the farmland is up in Iowa. He said, 1 square mile of Iowa farm topsoil, he said, if it were located somewhere in South America, it would be fenced off as a national park. It would be that unusual. There have been a lot of studies done, and some very recently, about the rainforest of the Amazon. You know, the Brazilian government thought they'd just go in, cut down these trees, it could, you know, extend farming into the interior of the country. They find out there's no stability to that soil. There is no topsoil there. And with the tremendous rains, the rains come, and the plants decay, and the plants, things grow so rapidly that trees and so forth, leaves decay, and that the nutrients are absorbed right into the growing plants that come afterwards. And what is not absorbed is washed away in these giant rivers. Sometime you ought to take a look, maybe again, just pull out your atlas. Look at North America and compare it with South America. What's the major difference? One has a heartland, and the other one doesn't. You know, where is the strength of the United States and Canada? It's in the interior. That's where the great food production areas are, the vast plains with this rich topsoil, well-watered, rain in due season, not too much. Compare that. It's just the opposite in South America. People all scattered around the coast. And the interior of South America is just, for all practical purposes, worthless. So God didn't put our peoples in South America. He put them up in North America. Okay, raw materials. The other factor of after food and their natural resources. This is also very important. A nation that has abundant raw materials is by nature going to be stronger than one who doesn't. We'll have to get its raw materials from the outside. That's why Japan, in some ways, is a very fragile society. Oh, we're very familiar with the resurgence of Japan in post-World War II era and the abundance, you know, the standard of living that the Japanese have today. But it's capable of being cut off just at any moment. There are practically no resources in Japan except coal. Everything else has to come from the outside, coal and rice. If any of you have traveled in Japan, have taken the train, this fast high-speed train from Tokyo down to Osaka and even south, you see everywhere rice is growing, right up to the train tracks. Now they've tried, you know, through multiple cropping to grow as much food as possible to be self-sufficient. They've done that. But as far as other natural resources and minerals, they have practically nothing. Everything has to be brought in from the outside. And yet the Japanese don't have a worldwide navy. They don't have a defense force really to speak of. They're dependent upon the United States. So it is a society that really structurally is built upon clay. Raw materials are very, very important. And you're going to see the factor of raw materials come into play during the 1980s as perhaps the most critical issue, because again, that's what's going to draw many nations into the unstable parts of the world, specifically the Middle East. Focus their attentions there. The International Institute for Strategic Studies in London correctly pinpointed the Western world's most, as they say, this is quoting now, most serious security challenge of the 1980s. How to assure the supply from an unstable third world of the raw materials on which its economic well-being, domestic stability, and political cohesion had come to depend. So, 1980s, how to make sure you can still get the oil from the Middle East, how you can still get the resources from Southern Africa, because Southern Africa is, as others have said, the Persian Gulf of minerals. And South Africa is its Saudi Arabia. It's as important in mineralogically as the Middle East is in oil. Most Americans have no realization how dependent they are on the mineral wealth in that part of the world. Now, just as far as oil is concerned, Fred Hartley, chairman and president of the Union Oil Company in California, one of the big oil companies, especially in the West Coast, said this recently in a speech in Los Angeles. Historically, we've been able to play a leadership role in world affairs because of our strength, founded on our dynamic utilization of an abundant supply of energy. And then he goes on to show how we had, you know, we were abundant in oil in World War II before our economy had grown so large and we'd become so dependent upon it, that the Allies in World War II were dependent upon exports of American oil. Maybe we've forgotten that. We were a net exporter of oil, you know, before, I'd say, even through the 60s. I'm not sure of the exact time, but really 1970s, we began to become critically dependent ourselves on the Middle East. But World War II, it was two factors. Remember the old phrase? The arsenal of democracy, or industrial capacity, was so great. Plus the fact that we had the oil, which was necessary to run modern warfare. Whereas the Germans were intent, you know, they had to take over Romania with the oil fields. They were pushing into the Middle East when they were stopped by the British at El Alamein and so forth. Mr. Hartley said, he continues, he said, our world leadership, economic, military, and political, has become vulnerable because of energy vulnerability. So the United States is critically dependent on an unstable part of the world, and soon the Soviet Union will be too. And I have another report here, but I think I've already mentioned that. So the eyes of the world are going to be focused increasingly upon the instability of the Middle East, which, of course, the Soviet Union is doing its best to destabilize. What about minerals? As I said, it's not just oil. We've become critically dependent upon an unstable part of the world for minerals. This country is dependent, said E.F. Andrews, Vice President of Allegheny Ludlum, a big mineralogical concern back east, is dependent upon imports for about 20 vital minerals. 20. And there are a few on which we have no leverage whatsoever. 50% of the world's known supply of manganese, for example, is in South Africa, and the other 50% is in Rhodesia and Russia. And the funny thing about the vital minerals is they're located in abundance in two primary areas, neither of which are, really bode ill well for the future, Southern Africa or Russia. And that's the reason why the Soviet Union is concerned about destabilizing Southern Africa to play up, shall we say, the human rights, sociological issues there, rather than the strategic elements, which are far more intrinsically important. We don't know how to make steel without manganese, he said. It has no substitute. No substitute. Other minerals in which the United States is import dependent in varying degrees are these: vanadium, cobalt, bauxite, cadmium, platinum, diamonds, gold, and chrome, and several others. He said you can put chrome at the top of the list. Of the 3.7 billion tons of known chrome reserves in the world, 3.6 billion are in Rhodesia and South Africa. 3.6 out of 3.7. And he said, it's a frightening story. Without chrome, he said, we can't make jet airplane engines, we can't drill an oil well, and we can't dig a mine. And he said, you can't even make tin cans, because tin cans are not made out of tin, are they? I think they're steel with chrome. So it even affects your food processing industry. And so he said he was concerned about the high Russian profile in this part of the world. Of course, the United States depended upon bauxite, too, from which, comes aluminum, and that affects, along with chrome, our entire airframe industry, doesn't it? I mean, Boeing is one of your big money earners in the world, and they're producing, the 757, 767 new aircraft, lines of aircraft. They need constant access to aluminum. Okay, industrial capacity, just briefly cover some of these other factors. The United States, of course, has had tremendous industrial capacity. The Soviet Union has it too, but of course it's shackled by an outmoded economic system that it's not able really to marshal its vast resources that it has. Morgenthau says here, it is inevitable that the leading industrial nations should be identified with the great powers, and a change in industrial rank, for better or worse, would be accompanied by a change in status of national power. And what is happening? What have the industrialists of this country been complaining about in the last few years? Lack or slippage in productivity, right? Our productivity is just limping along. There are many factors involved in this. Some of them are sociological factors. You have various type of high-cost programs mandated by the government, such as the various reverse discriminatory systems and so forth, which, of course, take time to get people who aren't trained for the job. Very, very inefficient. But then, of course, you have aging plants. Capital formation is the biggest problem perhaps affecting American industry today. You have heavy taxes, very heavy. You ought to compare sometime the taxes on capital gains in the United States as opposed to West Germany. They're much lower in West Germany. That's why people save over there, high rate of savings, because they know their money is not going to be taxed away from them. They can invest in industry. The government, again, is not going to produce disincentives to do so. I heard the other day on the radio, it was an interesting program, again, reflections of the 1980s as far as industry is concerned, and there's one expert said this. He said, if we had, in 1850, the same tax laws that we have today, we would never have developed this country west of the Mississippi, because the tax laws are so punitive, and they discourage investment. They're disincentives. And, of course, this really runs counter to all principles. I mean, you just look through what God says about you know, the values of work and labor and profits and whether you should, you know, whether you, the labor is worthy of his hire and so forth. All the factors in the Bible runs counter to everything in the book of Proverbs, the way this country is run. Now we have the prospect of windfall profits, and what, $227 billion over the next 10 years or whatever it is. And the thing that, to me, that is so disturbing is that the politicians in this country have already mentally spent that money. They already have it earmarked. They can't wait till they get their hands on the so-called windfall profits. Well, where is the windfall profits going? It's going to the government and the various type of spending programs that they want to launch, various type of social welfare programs, going to further sap the industrial capacity and strength of this country. Okay, military preparedness. We don't have time to go into all of these things. I just want to give you a few factors so that you can consider, you can think about as you read the papers, read the news magazines, your own personal news watching over the next months and years as we begin the 1980s. Military preparedness. What gives the factors of geography, natural resource, and industrial capacity their actual importance for the power of a nation is military preparedness. Can you turn that those factors of power when necessary in times of threat from adversary powers? Can you turn that to the benefit of the country? The United States has lost, for all practical purposes, the race with the Soviet Union. In the last 15 years, the Soviets have caught up to the United States in a headlong rush. I mean, they have really moved fast. There was an article, I won't read it here, in the U.S. News and World Report just in November, showing a two-page article showing what they have done. In 15 years, the United States has virtually stood still while the Soviet Union has caught up. And the idea was, on the part of our own planners in the United States, well, if we cut back, you know, the spending on the military technology, weaponry, so forth, that will set a good example for the Soviet Union. And whenever the U.S. has cut back, the Soviets have gone ahead. Whenever the U.S. has gone ahead, the Soviets have gone ahead. They haven't slowed down one bit. They've gone pell-mell. And, of course, the poor Russian peasant has had to pay for all of this. That, I think, is the tragedy of it all. The poor Russian people locked into that system. I was there in the Soviet Union in 1974. And I'll never forget going into the food stores, the state-run food stores, and seeing what type of schlock, that's all you can say, was available for the Russian people to eat. If you want to buy anything edible in the Soviet Union, you go to the private markets where you pay three or four times. You see, so there is capitalism inside the Soviet Union. Believe it or not, you know, the Russian peasants, they can grow a certain amount of food on their own plots where they live. They're given maybe a hectare or whatever it is of ground in order to do so, and they can grow as much as they want to. And they're really adept at capitalism in this permissible manner. See? They take that stuff to the free markets in the cities, and they sell it and make a lot of money. Now, when I was there, I tried to take pictures in this one free market stall in Moscow until the manager of the department came over and took me to the back room. And he said, Niet, no, don't take pictures. They're very ashamed of it, as I should think they should be ashamed. But if you can't afford that type of food, you have to buy it in the state-run shops. I mean canned goods that are leaking out of the seals, the cans that are rusty, the labels upside down, just pure junk. And then you go into the meat stalls, and meat that was actually, I couldn't even describe what the cuts were. You know, it looked like hunks of meat that had just been chopped up any old which way and wrapped around one way with the ends exposed to freezer burn, just lying in this chest. I wouldn't touch it. But that's what the Soviet people have to put up with in order that their leaders can put their money, marshal their money into the giant military machine that they have. It really is a pity, and it'll be a welcome relief someday that the Russian people can be freed from that type of bondage. The United States is losing the race with the Soviet Union as far as military philosophy is concerned. We've had this concept over the last few years of mutual assured destruction, or madness, as some have said, mutual assured destruction, mad. And the idea has been, and here you have to understand the difference between the mentality of the Israelitish peoples and some of the major Gentile powers of the world. They don't think the same way we do, but we perceive in our folly. God says that Israel are like sheep. We try to be nice to people, You know, that they certainly are, quote, as good as we are, and they know, they can understand, you know, they view things the same way we do. The United States, its leaders, have thought for years that nuclear war is not only unthinkable, it's unwinnable. And therefore, the United States needs enough, you know, of military superiority to ensure that if the Soviets attack, there would be enough left, you know, behind to for a second strike on the Soviets, and they would think twice. But the Soviet Union doesn't think that way. From everything that I've read, and we have several sources, we have 160 sources at our disposal, some of them are translations of top military thinking and philosophy in the Soviet Union. The Soviets aim to win, not only to fight, but aim to win, if necessary, not that they want to. They'd rather have the whole world peaceably, you know, put pressure, build up massive force that can't be contested, and so the world would fall in their lap. But the Soviet philosophy, nevertheless, is to win a nuclear war, as, shall we say, as unthinkable as that may sound to us. The Soviet government, this is a quote from some of their literature, the Soviet government and the armed forces of the Soviet Union and the other socialist countries must be prepared above all to wage war under conditions of the mass use of nuclear weapons by both belligerent parties. The ability to use them before the opponent does is the key to victory in such a war. And that's why the Soviet Union has a very advanced civil defense program, because they expect some sort of attack on themselves, but they want to be able to escape with the least, you know, the minimum harm. Now, the very fact that the Soviets could be considering such ideas of a nuclear first strike, it runs counter to the thinking, as I said, of most American planners. And one was confronted with this idea, and this author for Saturday Review magazine said he cornered this one American expert and asked him, you know, is this really true? Could the Soviets be thinking this? And this, his answer from this expert was, human beings don't act that way. What do you mean human beings don't act that way? Did Hitler act that way? You know, it seems to me he did pretty dastardly things. And then this other expert said the Soviets would have to be redefined as something other than human were they really serious about such a strategy. No, there is such a difference in mentality. There is the mind of the Israelite sheep. Then there is the mind of some of those leaders in other countries who have the minds of predatory animals. Quantity and quality of armed forces under military preparedness. Look what's happening in the United States. We have a volunteer army, a very, shall we say, meager stature. And to me, one of the most disturbing trends I've ever seen is the pressure on the part of, in the Pentagon, and especially from the women's lib movement, the feminist movement, to try to move more women into combat roles. Can you imagine that? Even Hitler didn't do that in World War II. You know, what happened in the last few days of World War II, even the Japanese? They drafted into their home guard underage and overage men, you know, 13, 14-year-olds and men up to 65. But they never thought, even those nations never thought of using women in combat. But this is the type of thinking, first of all, naval and air force, first of all, but then it would, and surely, if it ever got going, even extending it to the army in the United States. Now, there have been several hearings in Congress on these proposals to draft women, or to enlist women, not draft, into active combat roles, into that type of training. And this one man, who was a military man who was very much against it, he said, the United States is losing its moral fiber. He said, the fact that this nation is considering sending our young women, young ladies, to war is one more bridge too far. But that's the type of thinking. And there have been others who have been testifying at these hearings. Some men who have been prisoners of war in Vietnam and Korea and others, and have told of the terrible afflictions that they have suffered in some of the jails, the terrible torture. They said it was bad enough for a man to go through these inhuman things, but to send a woman into it is unthinkable. And a General Gutsis said this in one of the hearings. He said, how can we as a civilized people even begin to entertain the thought of sending our women into such an environment against their will? And yet the feminist movement is using this lever of the military as an issue to jump upon for some of their equal rights equal rights drives. And it's already moving full speed ahead, shall we say. We see the number of women in active participation in the armed services isn't tripled since 1972. And there's so many women now in the Navy, aboard ship, that the Pentagon has actually, and I have a picture, I could hardly believe it when I saw it the other day, has designed a blue maternity uniform for women aboard ship. Maternity uniform. Because so many are getting pregnant. Well, guess where they're getting pregnant? From the midshipmen. Because most of these pregnancies are illegitimate. But the good old military is coming along with free maternity care, too. Of course, in our military, we see more of an unbalance. Minorities are represented in the military about three times their average representation, percentage representation in the population as a whole. And that is another unstable factor, because if you have certain groups that are considered to be, or told by the government that you are an officially recognized oppressed minority, therefore, you know, how can these people fight with any type of conviction for the country? Population. Other factors. Population is a major one. The United States, remember what we got back to the beginning, talking about the blessings of the breasts and of the womb. We've been given fantastic population resource in this country. The massive immigration waves of the 1920s. I wouldn't even be here if my parents hadn't immigrated from Sweden in the 1920s. That's when it really came to, shall we say, to the fore. From 1870 to 1940, the United States increased by 100 million people. And the combined increase of France and Germany was about 31 million people. So it was plenty cannon fodder, shall we say. Plenty manpower to draw from in the tests of national will that were to come. And yet, look at the problems in the United States. The country is divided many, many different ways. We have changed our immigration patterns. And now we have the problem of illegal aliens, which is one of the most serious social problems that most people don't even set their minds to realize how critical this is. Who knows how many illegal aliens there are? 2 million? 12 million? The fact, if you imagine that the experts even dispute how, you know, there could be that wide a disparity. 2 to 12 million people, illegal aliens. As one expert said, no nation having any self-respect would ever permit such a massive violation of its own laws. And yet it's happening here. National morale, national character, I don't think we have to cover that too much. I think we've mentioned it in passing in some of these other factors. A very elusive factor that can change as the years go by. National morale, as Morgenthau says, can change. National morale is only tested really at the time of national stress in warfare. And as he says, it can be brought close to the breaking point by tremendous losses. Useless losses in warfare. And the national morale in this country was really broken in Vietnam, where the war was fought. The lesson of Korea was not learned, and the war not to win was fought. It lasted 12 years, a loss, 50,000 men, 200 to 300 billion people, I mean $300 billion, down the drain. And now we can see what has happened in Southeast Asia since then. So Vietnam did indeed break America's pride. Then we have other divisions in the society. America is no longer can focus. America's always been a country of disparate interests. You have to have that in a free society. But it's gone from disparate interests that can cooperate in times of crisis to disparate interests who demand their own way regardless of the good of the country. So you have gray power, gay power. You know, a mayor of San Francisco can't be elected unless it gets full support of the gay community. Red power, black power, sunbelt power, environmental power, hard hat power, you name it. Even the handicap lobby is very, very strong. They've gone, you know, beyond the reasonable demands to demand, you know, wholesale rehabilitation of transit systems, you know, just for a very, very select minority. So beyond reasonable demands. The United States doesn't have pride in its power anymore. It has instead guilt. You'll see this. If you read the newspapers, read the editorials and read how that there's very little pride, but the United States instead is responsible, according to many journalists, for all the problems in the world. We're guilt-ridden. Fearfulness, you know, like it says in Leviticus 7, Leviticus 26, I won't read that, verses 7, 17, 36, 37, around there. Instead of 100 putting 1,000 to flight, our leaders, in effect, flee. You know, the merest drop of a leaf. We feel, as a country, that the United States is the one, is the real imperialist power in the world. We've turned tables on our own thinking. An attitude of self-doubt, if not self-hate, motivates this country. I'm trying to skip over a few things here. Then we come to the factor of quality of diplomacy. We've discussed some of these other factors at the beginning: geography, resources, population, all things that the United States has possessed in abundance. But all of these factors really are worth nothing unless the leadership of the country can marshal these resources together and project them onto the world scene and its relationship, say, with the Soviet Union and other countries, in a forceful manner. Diplomacy, Morgenthau said, this is very interesting because it ties in with the scripture we'll read. Diplomacy, one might say, is the brains of national power, as national morale is its soul. Turn to Isaiah 1. We'll see a very similar reference there. Isaiah 1, at the second half of verse 5, the whole head is sick, God says, of our country. The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. What is the head? You know, what does your head do? It directs all the other members of the body. Without the head, you know, you're absolutely nothing. And the whole heart is faint. That means the soul. So the government is sick. The government is directionless, leaderless. And the soul, or the national morale of the people, is very, very low, dangerously low at this time. If the vision of a country is blurred, its judgment is defective, all of the other factors of national power are really worthless. Geography, geographical advantage, abundant resources to conduct, you know, a warfare if necessary, industrial production capacity, military preparedness, population, all of these things, good-sized population, all of these other factors are really nothing if there is no vision. You know, where there's no vision, the people perish. And that's really what is happening in this country. There's no vision. The vision is blurred. Who is the enemy? You know, when President Carter said in 1977 that the United States had at last shed its, inordinate fear of communism, which caused us to embrace various other type of dictators, as he put it. But, you know, to practically wish away the Cold War shows that the vision is blurred. Morgenthau says that a nation that loses these other factors through no projection onto the world scene with quality diplomacy may achieve temporary successes through the sheer weight of its natural assets. You know, these assets will carry it through for a certain period of time if it has these others in abundance. When he talks about the United States has had the benefit of material conditions that even poor statescraft could hardly dissipate. And yet they're being dissipated now. You know, all these other factors have carried us through up until this time. But now they are dissipating very, very quickly. Then the factor of national morality. I really don't have time to go into that too much, but I think you yourself can think about that. That's almost worth a subject of itself. National morality. You know, even the proverb says, what? Righteousness exalts a nation, exalts a kingdom. Is there righteousness in this country? Well, God says in the very chapters we were reading, in in the first few chapters of Isaiah, God calls our country and our country, or the leaders of the country, you rulers of Sodom. That's what he calls us. You rulers of Sodom. Now, you need to know what does that mean? What is Sodom? What is the modern parallel of Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, if you wait until the April edition of the Plain Truth magazine, it's going to be a fine article on really what the parallel is today. It's more than just, shall we say, gay rights and so forth. It's much deeper than that. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed for a totally licentious, in many aspects, a totally licentious lifestyle, to use the modern terminology. And it was quite broad. Total licentiousness. I'll give you an interesting example of this the other day. I was really surprised. I got a envelope in the mail from Orlando, Florida, from a company that I'd never heard of, hardly a company. But this was an invitation to me to join an elite swingers group. And it was a real heavy come on. And very elaborately done up. It was a letter of invitation. And then, as I said, very shrewd language, and with some additional comments written in hand. It was printed, but, you know, it showed handwriting. We know that you're the type of person that we want, and that type of thing. And what did they say? We have what you want, and this, all that sort of stuff. Anyway, but here was an invitation, out of the blue. How did I get that? I don't know. It must have been that my name on the News Bureau list was purchased by some of the publications that we have coming into the office. Some of them come in under my name. So this organization, whatever it was, I forgot what the name of it, bought that list. And openly, you know, advertising perhaps to what they perceived was the middle echelon of management, you know, around the country, inviting them to take part in this licentious activity. So national morality is very, very poor in the United States now, and we all know that. And yet the government persists in setting its tones for morality. You know, there's really no power of religion left. Morality used to be set by the religions of this country, by the churches. They're the ones that set the moral tone. And as the churches have declined in power and authority, the government has stepped in with its brands of morality, which are even worse. So the fact that we have the other day a directive sent out by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to the fact that sexist words were to be eliminated from government publications. Did you see that? In the newspapers that no longer use, in government publications, at least in that massive bureaucracy, have to use words such as manpower, he, she, father, mother, milkman is not to be used anymore. It's a dairy products delivery person. Sheer idiocy. But the government is going off. The social manipulators are moving the government into incredible areas. And we're being forced into a mold, a moral mold of the government's making. Interesting book that came out. I would certainly recommend that you read it if you ever have a chance. It came out last year, Time for Truth. It was written by William Simon. I quoted this in the latest Plain Truth. I don't know if it's out yet, but he was talking about how we really don't have freedom in this country. He said, we have freedom in areas that we shouldn't have freedom in. He said, it's often said by people who receive warnings about declining freedom in America that such a charge is preposterous, that there's no freer society on the face of the earth. He said, that's true in one sense, but it's immensely deceptive. There's never been such freedom before in America to speak freely, including indeed to wag one's tongue in the hearing of an entire nation, to publish anything and everything, including the most scurrilous gossip. And even this church has been, of course, a victim of that type of, shall we say, social framework. To propagandize for bizarre sexual practices, such as I was the victim of. To watch bloody and obscene entertainment, like cowboy football. No, I'm not talking about bloody maybe, but not obscene. Okay. Conversely, compulsion rules the world of work. You know, there are restrictions on planning and investing and who to hire and who to fire and so forth to invent. The stimulation to really move forward is being taken out. He said, the strange fact that Americans are constitutionally free today to do almost everything that our cultural tradition has previously held to be immoral and obscene, while the police powers of the state are being invoked against almost every aspect of the productive process. And now, this is my own words, not his. We see in this increasingly godless, immoral society where the government is dictating its brand of morality, that we see the massive powers of government even turning relentlessly against what remains of the free exercise of religion. Believe me, brethren, what has happened to the church, you know, what happened nearly a year ago could never have taken place, you know, 10 or 20 years ago without the massive growth of government bureaucracy. Would never have. There was respect for religion. Religion was here in this corner. Government had its responsibilities here. The twain didn't meet. But now they are meeting and clashing head on. As one expert said, his Oxford professor R.M. Hartwell, he said, the state has increasingly replaced the church in determining how we should live. Politics is now religion. Or as another person said, statism, which means big government, is a political religion, a surrogate for Christianity and Judaism. As I said, we would never have had this problem with a smaller government that wasn't trying to dictate lives, our lives. Okay, the last factor quality of government really is just an outgrowth of quality diplomacy. As Morgenthau said, someone get the phone, please. The best conceived and most expertly executed foreign policy, drawing upon an abundance of material and human resources, must come to naught if it cannot draw also upon good government. And yet, isn't this really where the real problem lies? Isn't this what Mr. Armstrong has even said? The whole issue is government. And anything, you know, as far as government of God versus the government of Satan. Satan's influence religions and governments upon this earth. And it is a question of government overall. And the quality of government. Instead of statesmen today, we have mere politicians. You know the difference between a politician and a statesman is? A statesman goes the way he knows is good for the people to go, whether or not they believe him. He sets, you know, the pace. The people don't tell him what to do. A politician's always listening to, what do the people want, you know? Oh, the people want this, the people don't like the oil companies. The people feel the oil companies are the, okay, let's slap this windfall profit tax. Or other things like that. Just in response, I'm using that only as an example, in response to the public mood. That is the politician. A statesman must think in terms of the national interest as conceived in terms of power among other powers. What is the power of the country, as it say, vis-a-vis the Soviet Union? It was interesting that the Shah of Iran, after he was toppled from power, said this in West Germany. He looked at what had happened to his country and how he had been eased out. The United States did not, you know, come to his aid. In fact, an individual from the Pentagon was sent down to literally force him out of the country. And he said this afterward. He said, in my 37 years of rule, I met statesmen such as Roosevelt, Stalin, Churchill, De Gaulle, Eisenhower, and Nehru. They must be turning over in their graves seeing who their successors are. The total self-abandonment of the West is getting worse and worse. When it finally wakes up, it will be too late. There are no leaders left. Instead of leaders in front, ruling over, shall we say, a minimum-sized government, we have a giant bureaucracy. One hand of which doesn't know what the other hand is doing. That obvious clashing interest, the environmentalist EPA agency says do this, you know, the Department of Energy says, let's, you know, encourage the use of coal, and the EPA says, no, we can't do that. You know, we can't harm the environment. So one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing. We have no leadership left. Turn over that last scripture to Isaiah 3, something that I've used in some of the things I've been writing lately, but I think it's very apropos here. Isaiah 3, for behold, the Lord of hosts, is taking away from Jerusalem and from Judah, verse 2, the mighty man and the soldier, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50, the men of rank, any of those who really have leadership capacity, whether they are in government or they are in the military structure. Notice that the judge and the prophet, you know, nobody kind of like the Bernard Baruchs that used to advise presidents, men of real wisdom, they're gone. But there are a few prophets. And those of you who come back tomorrow, we're going to discuss some of them. There are some secular prophets that are worthwhile reading. A few of them are real Cassandras. You know, those are pronouncing various dire warnings upon this country. You need to have knowledge of some of these people in your own private news watching. But aside from that, these type of people are gone. The leaders are gone. Verse 4, and I will make boys their princes. Not that a 10-year-old or my nascent teenager is going to be the ruler, but it means comparison. Boys are their princes, and babes shall rule over them. And the end of verse 5, and the base fellow to the honorable. Even, I think, describes some of the men who are in high positions in the White House today who do some rather base things. Verse 12, my people, children are their oppressors, women rule over them. O my people, your leaders mislead you and confuse the courts of your pants. The leadership is gone. So that most important factor of all, which is able to marshal all these other aspects of national power, to really put the convenient package on all of it, that is missing. For without leaders, without government, what value is the factor and benefit of good geographical position, natural resources, abundant population, so forth? These other factors are not really worth much anymore without this most important factor of all, which is government.